Coast to Coast guest Jeffrey Mishlove, PhD, talks about our special guest tonight, Mark Seifer, by saying, how is it possible for consciousness to exist in the physical universe? He says this is the classic mind-body problem that has eluded philosophers for many generations. Now it appears that answers are within reach. The depth of Mark Seifer's scholarship and the clarity of his thinking make this special work, Transcending the Speed of Light, a very worthwhile read for anyone interested in the frontiers of consciousness research. In a moment, Dr. Mark Seifer joins us on Coast to Coast AM. Incredible topics tonight with Mark Seifer. Mark is an internationally recognized expert on Nikola Tesla. He's the author of The Wizard, The Life and Times of Nikola Tesla. His latest book, Transcending the Speed of Light, explores the relationships between thoughts, the physical universe, and the speed of light. Now, he's also studied graphology and has appeared on the History Channel for his work doing handwriting analysis on the Howard Hughes Mormon will and on the AP International for his analysis of Osama bin Laden's signature. Here he is, Mark Seifer. Hey, Mark, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Hey, I've got to ask you about this Osama bin Laden situation. Tell me about that story.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to tell you that my name is pronounced Seifer.
Seifer?
Yeah, like decipher.
Why did they tell me Seifer?
That's okay.
Well, that's all right. You're Seifer. You're in the Seifer world.
Yeah.
Okay. Osama bin Laden, tell me about that.
It's a very amazing story. This was going back a few years ago when they weren't sure whether he was alive or not, and a letter came in to the government, and to the Associated Press called me up from New York, and I'm in Rhode Island, and they said, we want to fax you Osama bin Laden's signature. Can you tell if it's really his signature or if it's a forgery? And we'll have cameras up there in like 2 hours. I said, wait a second. I've never seen this signature at all. I need a full day. You got to give me a full day for this. So they said, okay, we'll be there tomorrow at 12 noon. So they sent me up Osama bin Laden's known signature, and they sent me up another signature, which they want to know whether or not it was his.
Right.
Now, again, I mean, now we all know he's alive, but if you've got to go back 4 or 5 years. We really didn't know if he was dead because he had a kidney disease, and there was a real question about it. So there was a great deal of pressure on me as to, because I was going to say whether or not I thought he was alive, essentially. That was what it came down to. So I called my friend Uri Geller and asked for his advice. He's linked to the Mossad, and I thought he might have some information about bin Laden. And he said, Mark, he said, you know, just be cautious. Don't really put yourself out on a limb, and just be cautious. So that's what I did. So I got the handwriting, and I also went online, and I have a friend in Israel who sent me another signature of his through email, and I thought it looked like his. It was a little bit shaky,
okay.
And it seemed to me that he was probably ill. But also, his signature is very unusual. He's made up a design. It's not Arabic, and it's not English. He was schooled, in English schools. He studied engineering.
Right.
So part of his signature has Arabic to it, and part of it has English to it. And he's got two giant circles in his signature, and then he has a long trailing line that looks kind of like scaffolding or buildings or things like that. So one circle is open and clear, and the other circle has almost like a giant M in it, and looks very much like the anarchy sign. So I saw it as yin-yang. I think, you know, God and the devil. I really feel like he's pulled in both directions, and you could see the duality in his name. So I analyzed the handwriting from a forgery point of view. I said it matches very much. I said it's not a hard signature to forge. I think it looks to me like it's his, but it looks like he's ill when he's writing this. But I also analyzed it graphologically, symbolically, and then it went all around the world.
That's remarkable, Mark.
Yeah, it was a great moment, in that instance.
Are you convinced he's still alive out there somewhere?
Yes, I was watching Bill Maher yesterday, and they think that he's in a hotel, a condo in Pakistan someplace.
Being well protected, no doubt.
Yes, yes. It's truly amazing that we haven't gotten to him.
It really is. Almost like we don't want to, Mark, but that's another story all by itself. Uri Geller, dear friend of ours as well. I just think the world of him, and he's a good person. I mean, it's nice to know that you two are friends. Tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got interested in all of this. And we'll, I do want to talk with you about Nikola Tesla. We'll do that next hour.
Okay. Well, I went to I graduated from University of Rhode Island and then went back to New York, and I studied graphology at the New School for Social Research for a few years, and I wanted to be the best handwriting analyst in the world. That became my goal, and I applied to the University of Chicago, and I got in there. In fact, I do have a graphology book that'll be out in December, and it's called The Definitive Book of Graphology, so I'm very happy about that. So we're back in the early 1970s, and I was studying graphology as well as psychology with all the, you know, the people at the University of Chicago. There, Bruno Bettelheim was there. You know, he was the world's leading psychoanalyst.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with medical doctors studying schizophrenic handwritings. And then I also was writing a master's thesis on a totally different topic. I decided to study Carl Jung's theories. I was studying Freud with Bettelheim, and I had taken a course on Carl Jung, and I had never really known much about the collective unconscious and all of that. And so I began to explore that further, and I came across a book by Frederick Myers called Human Personality and Its Survival of Bodily Death. It was written in 1901. That was his title, And Its Survival of Bodily Death. So I studied that, and he talked about the universal mind, that all minds are interconnected. And so what I came up with was a model based on all this research of, in a sense, a mandala, where, say, you have God or the great I Am in the center, and we're all spokes off the wheel. So you have a conscious, preconscious, and unconscious, then we all share a collective unconscious. So in other words, all minds actually are interconnected, and what telepathy essentially is would be you go down into your unconscious and you come up through someone else's subconscious, and in general it would be more common between twins or people that have similar interests or this kind of thing. So I wrote my master's thesis on going beyond Freud and Jung into parapsychology, and I'd never studied this field before. And I was studying out-of-body experiences, and I was studying experiments that they were doing with out-of-body experiences, Life After Death. There's a real good book I forget her name, Rosemary Brown, it might be. But anyhow, she writes music. She's written something like 400 symphonies. It's called Unfinished Symphonies is the book. And so Rachmaninoff appears to her, and you know, all these great dead people that write music. And so there's a lot of evidence for all this. And when I came back to Rhode Island, I went to Providence College, and I had designed a course in parapsychology. So I began to teach parapsychology for literally 15 years, and that opened up a whole new world for me. I met Andrea Puharich and Tom Bearden and, a lot of the great psychics.
Absolutely. The heavy hitters of the fields.
Yeah, Matthew Manning spoke in my class. Became friends with Uri Geller. There was a healer that I knew, and Ingo Swann was famous for remote viewing. I interviewed him. And things would happen. For instance, I went to a conference with Manning at the time, and I saw a halo appear above his head. I mean, it's not something, you look for. I mean, all of a sudden, there's a ring of light above the guy's head. I mean, that was, this amazing thing that would happen. And, of course, when we were in Geller's apartment, I wrote a lead article for him on him in ESP Magazine, and he bent the key right while I was, just sitting in the room with him. My hands were almost touching his hands, and he just took this key and rubbed it, and the thing started to move. And there was a moment there where what I thought was real was no longer, I had entered this other entirely different world. So we went to interview Andrea Puharich. And he was actually working for the government as well.
Right.
And they were after him. And I said to him, how do you deal with this world? Because he said everything in his room had levitated. He was in touch with UFOs. And things had materialized in his house and things like that. He said that life was a learning curve. He didn't need to decide for sure it was, you know, either black or white, a yes or no, that just have a more open view of the world. And I have to tell you, George, that really changed my thinking, because I didn't have to decide for sure that UFOs were definitely there or not there. I'd just be open to it, open to the idea that these things are possible. That's really the key. And then to stay open-minded, but also to keep a scientific view of things. So that's been pretty much the way I look at things.
Good for you. We're gonna have a good time tonight, and also very informative, because you've learned a lot, Mark, in the years that you've been studying this. I met Uri, by the way, in St. Louis at a book signing. He was there, and I went up and introduced myself to him, and I wanted to get him on what was then a local talk show. And I talked him into it, and we stayed friends ever since. And then, of course, Coast to Coast is he appears a couple times a year for us. As a matter of fact, he was in Israel during the Hezbollah shelling, and a shell landed not too far from him when he was on the air with us.
Wow.
Well over a couple of years ago. It was just an amazing phone call.
He's been a tremendous friend of mine, and you know, someone that I can turn to. So I've been very, you know, fortunate for that relationship.
You said something interesting about telepathy. You said that it's, you know, we're all tied into this together, which I've always believed, and that we've got this ability with telepathy to reach down and pull out some other forms of information. And I believe, and I'm sure you do too, Mark, everybody's capable of doing this. Not everyone is doing it.
I'll tell you what happened literally yesterday.
Okay.
I woke up in the morning. I had a dream that the lady that cleans our house broke my bike in half. I told Lois, my wife, I said, I just had a dream about that. She fell asleep, and then she woke up, and she had a dream about me and her on a bike. Okay, that was not telepathy, but we both had a dream about bikes. So I'm waiting to go on this show tonight. I'm watching Antiques Roadshow. And this guy had a bike that was used in World War II in Great Britain. And he said, and this bike is a very interesting bike. And he snaps the thing in half because it folds in half so you can travel with it. And then he puts it back together. Now, that's synchronicity. I dreamt about a bike that broke in half, literally, this morning. I watch Antiques Roadshow, and there's a bike that folds in half. The point that I make, and I make in my book, Transcending the Speed of Light, I think it's probably a form of telepathy. I probably picked up Antiques Roadshow in my brain. It came up into my conscious. Had I never seen the show, I wouldn't have known that I was linked to this. But, you know, where do these dreams come from? So I'm simply suggesting let's be open to the possibility that our minds are open-minded, and that we pick up other vibrations. And if you log your dreams, you'll see that these kinds of things happen a lot more frequently than you think. I'll give you one more instance. This happened about 2 years ago while I was working on the book. I had a dream about a piano. Now, you know, whose dreams about it? I dreamt about a piano. I then go down the block to pick up some fruit to bring back to the house. Sitting on the side of the road is a big piano, and it says for free. You know, take this for free. I guess it was a broken piano. Someone wanted to get rid of it. There's another instance of that. I think it was telepathy. I think I just simply picked up the vibe, and I log them. That's another important thing, is to keep a journal and to put these things down.
Do you think you picked up the vibe, Mark, or do you think you may have done some form of remote viewing? And maybe your mind saw this piano in the dream state probably, but you were out there remote viewing all over the place.
That could very well be true. We did do studies in Metascience, a journal that I used to produce, on remote viewing. And my friend Howard Smuckler was the editor of the journal. Before that, he had moved out to California, and I was here in Rhode Island. And I had my class try to remote view to where he was. And he was in, I think, a subway. And one guy drew subways. I drew two cars on a street going under a tunnel. Someone else in the class drew almost the identical picture. It's in our journal. I mean, the angle of the cars and everything was almost the same. And so we've done studies with these kinds of things and been very successful. What I think it's a shift of consciousness. Where does your mind end? Like if you're sitting there right now as I'm talking to you, where does my field of mind end. And if you shift your thinking, for instance, I give as an example, suppose, can you see your mother's kitchen right now? I'm sure you can, George, right?
Sure. I've been in there so many times, you can picture it.
Right. So in some sense, you are there, you know? And that's the beginning stages, I think, of learning how to remote view, is to shift your focus of attention to a different, you know, place on the planet. But then start with places that you know. I like Megan's Bay in the Caribbean. So I can shift my consciousness to there. Now, am I really seeing it? I don't know. But that's the beginnings of what remote viewing would be.
Do you believe, I don't, in coincidences? See, I think it's synchronicity. I think it's precognition. I think it's other things other than coincidence. I happen to think, Mark, everything happens for a reason. The people you meet, the things that happen in your life.
I think a lot do. I've been trying to get certain books published that I have trouble getting published. I've got one book about a man falsely accused of murder. I've been trying 10 years to get this thing published. So I don't know. Maybe it does happen.
Yeah, but one day you'll run into the right publisher. That's synchronicity.
Yeah, that is. I'll tell you a really funny story. The Amazing Randy was coming to town, and at the time he was offering $10,000 for anybody who could do something psychic in front of him. So now I think he's up to 100,000 or a million.
No, he's up to a million now.
He's up to a million. So this is, you know, 20 years ago or thereabouts, who knows. But it was 10,000. So I told him, he knew about me from my work, and I had written or called or whatever to him, and I said I had an aura detector, a machine that could detect auras. So I met him at his hotel. He was speaking at the University of Rhode Island. And what I had was one of those portable radios, and when you got near it, it started to produce static. So I brought the portable radio. I set the thing up, and I said, now it's going to detect my aura. And I came near it, and, of course, it produced static. He says, that's not an aura detector. I said, well, you tell me what it is. And, of course, he wouldn't give me the 10 grand. So we started to talk about synchronicity. He didn't believe in it at all. He said, given all the events in the universe, some are bound to be coincidental. And then that was it. He went to speak at his conference, and I went my merry way. Well, the next day, I had to fly out to California, I think, and I had to switch planes in Newark. So I got on the plane, and I take my seat, and who am I sitting next to on the plane but Randy?
See?
It was the funniest thing in the world. We were both, you know, scheduled to sit right next to each other on the plane.
And this happens time and time again. Later on tonight, we'll take phone calls from people. And we'll, you know, we'll take calls, questions for you, of course, but also those who have had this kind of synchronicity occur, where you think about somebody and you run into them at an airport and you haven't seen them for years, or you know who's calling you on the telephone, or, you know, if you're in a relationship, you know what the other person's thinking. There's that connection. Lynn McTaggart calls it the field. I call it the wireless internet. You've got your own definition for it. It's out there. It's real, and it's happening every day.
That's for sure. It definitely is. Your close friends, you know you're in touch with them in this emotional, synchronistic or telepathic way all the time. I've got, you know, some of my soul buddies. I know we're always thinking about each other. You know, that vibe is there. And a lot of times when the phone rings, you say, boy, that's Elliot or whoever, you know, that is. You just know it. So I totally agree with you.
And, you know, Mark, once you tap into it, it can take you anywhere you want. Truly can. It can take you in certain directions. We're going to talk about healing in a little bit later when we come right back, and also precognition in some other areas. And then also, Mark, tell me real quickly, Transcending the Speed of Light, how'd you come up with that title?
I didn't. I called it the Space-Time Mind Continuum. I wanted to integrate the mind into the space-time continuum. And in the traditions, which is run by Ehud Sperling, he's an Israeli who was in Vermont, has a beautiful book company called Inner Traditions. They changed the title to Transcending the Speed of Light.
Did they tell you they were doing it?
Yeah, and I love it. I just love the title.
It's a good title. Stay with us. Mark Cipher is here. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight, Mark Cipher, his book, Transcending the Speed of Light. I'm looking forward to talking with him more about this. Hey, Ben, by the way, happy birthday to a dear friend of mine, regular Coast to Coast listener from Hawaii, Monica. She gives me regular reports on volcanic activity out that way. Just a delightful person. I've known her for some time. She puts her children and her family first, way ahead of herself, and it's kind of nice to know that in this day and age that somebody would do that. So, Monica, happy birthday. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Mark Seifer, Ph.D., his book, Transcending the Speed of Light. Next hour, we'll talk about some of his work on Nikola Tesla. Precognition, Mark, tell us about it, your interpretation.
Well, I think that things exist as probability futures. Right now, the probability future is that Barack Obama will be the next president because more people are obviously thinking about voting for him. But things aren't carved in concrete, so they exist as probabilities. The stock market just crashed. In 1929, there was a stock market crash, and in 1987, there was another stock market crash. If we look at astrology, for instance, what astrology looks at is the dynamic relationship between the planets. So you have, in both cases, in 1929 and 1987, Saturn was afflicted in Sagittarius. So what does that all mean? Are we separated from the rest of, you know, the cosmos? I think that if you look at the structure of the solar system, you have the Earth going around the Sun, and Mars is going around, and Saturn is going around, and there are tensions between these planets. But there's nothing at all unpredictable about the future in terms of the future movement of the planet. So we think of the future as completely uncertain, when in fact, if we look at it from that perspective, it's very certain. For the next 1,000, 100,000, millions of years, hopefully, all these planets are going to go around. So part of precognition deals with, I think, looking at a relationship to the solar system and if there is a relationship between the planets and our life. There's a fellow by the name of Michael Gauquin. He's a French guy, and he wrote a book called Cosmic Clocks. He didn't believe in astrology, and he studied 25,000 horoscopes, and he found Mars was very powerful in the horoscopes of athletes. Jupiter, I think, was linked to politicians. And he found, just by statistics, that there was a direct link. So there's many levels to precognition. But that's one of them, I think, is to realize that we should begin to really look at astrology again in a much more serious light. Most of the books on that topic are poorly written. You've got to go back and read Mark Edmund Jones, Don A. Rudyer, people like that. So that's one level of it. Another level, I think, for me, is to tap into your dreams. I'll give you a couple of instances.
Sure.
In my own life. I used to live on a farm it's called Carolina in Rhode Island. In fact, I lived with an actor, J.T. Walsh. He's no longer on the planet, but he's a good friend and he's a good actor. And right by his house was the main house. And there was a lot of inbreeding of the dogs at the main house. And these dogs hated me. And
what do you mean they hated you? You mean whenever you walked in there?
There was a pack of them. There was like six or seven of them, and it was dangerous to walk out at night. Okay. So if I'd go to see my friend JT, the dogs would come out, and it was a scary time. There was another dog. It was a miniature German Shepherd. Her name was Lady M, and she used to sleep at my house. She was also owned by the owner of the estate, but she was not part of this inbred pack. And I remember one day I went to see JT Walsh, and she leapt out and literally saved my life. She was, you know, guarding me away from these dogs. She just put herself in between me and the dogs, and I ran into my friend's house. Okay, so a couple of weeks later, I have a dream that all the dogs are nice to me. Now, that was very unusual. So the next day, literally the next day, I'm out on the estate, and I'm talking to the fellow who's taking care of the estate, and all the dogs came up, and they were nice to me. That was a very astonishing moment in my life.
Interesting. And you must have been a little leery as they were coming up to you, I would guess.
Yes, and I'm also aware that I had the dream. And it was like, you know, so if you don't log your dreams, you could never know that I was picking up some type of weird vibe. Let me tell you one more, which shows the kind of thing where you see the link between precognition, telepathy, and synchronicity.
Okay.
I had a dream that I was throwing tennis balls against an aircraft carrier. That was the dream. The next day, I go out with my brother-in-law. We go sailing. And he's getting the boat, and I'm waiting on the shore. And there are these two kids, about 8 or 9 years old, and they're throwing rocks at the boats. So, of course, I stopped them from throwing the rocks at the boats. But I couldn't help but see the connection. The night before, I dreamt about throwing a tennis ball at an aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
Next day, kids are throwing rocks at the boats. I think what happened, I think it was telepathy with the kids. I think they were probably did this all the time. They were planning on throwing rocks at boats. And I picked up the vibe of it.
Yes.
So there's the link between telepathy, synchronicity, and precognition. In other words, they're planning on doing it. So I'm seeing into the future, but they already know that they're going to do it. That's different than something called pure precognition, where you can't at all predict what's going to happen.
And they probably, Mark, went to sleep thinking about it, telling each other, hey, tomorrow we're going to toss rocks against boats again. They go to sleep, and that information is out there in the ether. It's out there in the field. It's out there wherever, whatever we want to call it. And you picked it up.
Exactly. Exactly. I had a lady in my class. She got real scared, and she started to close all the windows and stuff. And the next night, a thief tried to get into her house. The guy was probably casing the joint, and she picked up his vibe. It was that kind of, same kind of thing, you know. Kuharic used to call it a survival frequency. When something was really important, you were more likely to pick up, you know, if it was emotionally charged.
In the book, The Transcending the Speed of Light, more instances of precognition. You talk about a book called Titan, which was written, when, 1898?
Yes. A book called Titan was written about a large ship that sails to Europe, hits an iceberg, and sinks. And the ship doesn't have enough lifeboats, and a lot of people die. 14 years later, the Titanic actually lives this exact experience, and the name of the captain of the ship is the same as the name of the captain in the book. So you've got all these coincidences.
That is bizarre.
Just too amazing.
So one would assume that the author of the book somehow tapped into this. Somehow.
Yes.
It would have to be, right?
Yes, but what's so amazing about it, I call it the kicker, where you have one extra synchronicity which just puts it over the edge. A guy could write a book about a big boat that hits an iceberg and sinks, but he calls this boat the Titan, and it's the Titanic. So it would have been pretty amazing even without the name, but he's got the name of it. The other one that I have in the book is a book called Black Abductor. It's about a black revolutionary group that kidnaps a girl named Patty, and she ends up joining the revolutionary group. And then, of course, 3 or 4 or 5 years later, Patty Hearst gets kidnapped by a black revolutionary group, and she joins the group. What's so amazing to me about this is not only the name Patty, but also the idea that a person would join a group of people that kidnapped you. I mean, if Bin Laden kidnapped you or me, we would not join his group, no matter what.
No, we'd be toast by now, I think.
So there was amazing. There was a couple of kickers in that instance.
You also write about what I have always felt to be an incredible story, and that is truly the link between Lincoln and Kennedy, the very bizarre circumstances of their secretaries, their vice presidents. I mean, the whole thing, how they died, where at least the would-be thought assassins ended up. Very strange, isn't it?
It was. That's truly amazing. They were exactly 100 years apart. Kennedy's secretary was named Lincoln. Both were followed by a Ford. And Lee Harvey Oswald and John Wilkes Booth are both known for three names and the exact same letters in their name. One was shot in the Ford Theater, and the other one was shot in a Ford car. One ran from a theater, the other got caught in a theater. So there was all of those synchronicities. And Alan Vaughan, who wrote a book which had some of this information that I quoted him, he talked about extending it beyond that. So he went to the next, after Ford was Nixon. So he studied after Ford, after Lincoln was Ford, was Grant. So you had Lincoln, Ford, then Grant, and then 100 years later you had Kennedy, Ford, then Nixon. He noticed that Grant and Nixon had the same number of letters in their names. So he studied the presidency of Grant, and he found a lot of scandal in Grant's administration. So he predicted that there'd be scandal in Nixon's administration way before Watergate. This is when Nixon was going to China and was living high on the hog and speaking to people,
exactly,
the men that landed on the moon. So he extended it. And what I dealt with was the 20-year death cycle of the presidency. Every 20 years from Lincoln all the way through FDR and then Kennedy, was the president would die every 20 years, 1860, 1880, 1900, all the way up to 1960. So the big question was, whoever was president in 1980, would that person die? And it turned out to be Ronald Reagan. So there would be a problem.
And he did get shot.
Exactly, exactly. And one of the things I talk about in the book is there's a probability future that he would die in office. And he was dead in office in the mind of Hinckley, the guy who shot him. So to that extent, he was dead. But it's in what Lapsang Rampa calls the hall of future probability. If the future probability collapses to a real event, then it happens in the real world. But a lot of these things never happen in the real world. I give as an example Bob Dole. He ran for the presidency for 25 years. And he is the president of the United States in a hall of future probabilities that never manifested itself on the physical plane. So part of my book is dealing with this concept of hyperspace. We've got to deal with mental space. It's a very complicated realm, but it's a real realm. It's a real space that has to be added to the space-time continuum.
And maybe in another universe, a parallel universe, maybe Bob Dole is the president.
Yeah, maybe he is. I'm sure he's happy there, too.
Tell us about this other case that you write about, which was a screenplay called Hail to the Chief.
I wrote, in 1989, I came up with the idea, we have two people running for office. I'll give you and my thought was, why do we have to have Republicans and Democrats? Why couldn't you just simply have a famous person running for the presidency? So I thought of, at the time, Ted Turner. Was one of my choices, and Robert Redford was another. Robert Redford's too old now, and so is Ted Turner. But 20 years ago, in 1989, whenever it was, if either of those guys decided to run, there's a good chance that they could actually win. You could usurp the two-party system. So I wanted to have a female, and I made her a Democratic senator, and I wanted the Republican. I chose him to be a black general who did something terrible during Vietnam. So I wanted to create two scandals for the Republican and the scandal for the Democrat. So I had a black general for the Republican, a white female for the Democrat. She turns out to be seducing women, so she's got this sex scandal and she's married. And he killed somebody in Vietnam, which has been hidden. He was an assassin in Vietnam. So I have, as the third-party candidate, a newscaster. I was thinking of someone like Peter Jennings or Brian Gumbel or Tom Brokaw, someone who was real credible.
Right.
Decided to run.
And well-known, very well-known.
And the fourth I chose was a televangelist. So now, 20 years later, here we are in 2008, and you have a black Obama, a female senator, which was Hillary Clinton. You had the Vietnam link, which was McCain.
McCain, yeah.
And you have a televangelist who was Huckabee, and you have a newscaster who could have run, Lou Dobbs. There was a big movement to try and get Lou Dobbs.
Yeah, there was a shot there. That's right. Exactly.
But there's another aspect to the Hail to the Chief, and that is the concept of inevitability. I think, for instance, let's say Obama and McCain were not doing so well. Bloomberg, who was the mayor of New York. He was thinking about running as a third-party candidate. Now, if these guys started to crash and burn a little bit, he would have been a very credible third-party candidate. But I also think right now, I think if George Clooney, if the time was right, if George Clooney simply decided to run for president, he's certainly guaranteed 10 or 15% right off the bat. And if he becomes credible, In other words, a very famous person could easily usurp the two-party system.
Yes. Someone with name recognition has a leg up on a lot of them.
Yes.
Just on that alone. And like you say, if they're credible, honest, good, they could do really well.
Yeah. So the two-party system, I think, is very vulnerable. And look at all the money they've got to raise. They've got to raise hundreds of millions of dollars to run. But, if a George Clooney or if a Ted Turner or if a Bill Gates simply decided to run, people would think seriously about voting for these people.
Heck, Gates could cancel taxation and take care of it himself.
Right. Right, he could do the bailout all by himself.
Mark, with all these events, the telepathy, the dream telepathy, the synchronicity, the precognition, have you come up with your own theories on why it happens?
Yes. I think essentially we have a conscious, a preconscious, and an unconscious, and then we share this collective unconscious. I think that, Gurdjieff writes about something called the Kunda buffer. We have kundalini energy, this coiled serpent at the base of our spine. And according to Gurdjieff's theory, he's talking about the fall of man. At some point, we fell from grace. We had all these higher abilities, and then we blew it. And so God put this buffer on our serpent, on the base of our spine, and we lost access to a lot of our psychic powers. Now, we can all regain all that, I think, by simply living a better life, and I think tapping into our dreams. So I think that that's the first stage, is to simply start mapping your dreams and become aware of these kinds of events. And I think also children should be studying it. I've made this plea since the 1970s. Isn't it crazy that we don't study telepathy in universities, that there's not one university that takes telepathy seriously as something to simply study, that one brain could read the mind of another? So that's what I think it is. I think it's a form of resonance, and I think it's a form of learning more about your own psyche. And in my book, I'm making the case that we should add one more dimension. We've got a four-dimensional world. I'm saying we should have a five-dimensional world. And besides the three outer, we have height, width, and depth, we have three spatial dimensions. We also have one inner dimension of inner space, and that inner space is the mind. So you've got four spatial dimensions, one hyperspace and time. So I've got a five-dimensional universe. That's my starting point.
Mark, let's take just a few moments to talk about also the chapter you write about, and that's The Cure for Cancer, the chapter on Royal Rife specifically. I've been a believer that the human body can heal itself by tapping into that field, and I think you are too.
Yes, I think Christian Science believes in that. I was just lecturing on this today. He was the president of Rhode Island College. He was a Christian Scientist, and he had diabetes. So he wouldn't take his insulin shots because he thought the mind could cure his diabetes. He had three kids. He was in his early 50s, president of Rhode Island College. He died. Now, I think in theory he was right. If we lived on a mountain in Tibet, maybe we could cure our diabetes. I think potentially the mind can do all these things. But in the world we live in, we're neophytes. We don't really understand what the mind can do. I have a lot of physics in the book, but easily read physics. One of the things about when you learn about molecules, they're held together by light energy.
And Mark, let's talk a little bit more about Royal Rife when we come back and get your take on this. Our guest is Mark Seifer. His book, Transcending the Speed of Light. We'll also talk about Nikola Tesla when we come right back.